From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Millions of Americans have spent the last 2 years in a prolonged state of anxiety over our nation. Donald Trump's presidency has been so antithetical to so many of our expectations for who a president should be, how they should function and preside over the republic, that it has left us bewildered and confused. Even more confounding is the fact that millions of Americans voted for Trump. And while his support has eroded, there are still far too many that back his insanity no matter what he does. About 10 years ago, a clinical psychologist and author named Bryant Welch wrote about the state of the American mind. He has now released a new version of that book to tackle our current era. Bryant Welch is a nationally renowned clinical psychologist and attorney. He served as the first executive director for a professional practice of the American Psychological Association. He was an outspoken critic of the APA's involvement in the Bush-era torture of Iraqis. And State of Confusion was first released in 2008. The latest edition, examining the Trump era, is just out, and it's called State of Confusion, Political Manipulation, and the Assault of the American Mind. Bryant Welch now joins me. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sonali. It's nice to be here.
So when we try to make sense of the world that we live in today, sometimes it becomes tempting to just dismiss what feels like the crazies, those people who you just can't understand. You'll never be able to change their mind. Why bother trying to even make sense of where they're coming from? But the fact is, those are people in our midst. They're in our families. Even those of us living in places like California can count members of our family that are supporters of Trump that we just can't relate to. Why is it important for us to understand what's happening to the collective psychology of our nation?
Well, because there are millions of people like that with minds that are adhering to Donald Trump's agenda. Now, as I point out in State of Confusion, Trump is just a symptom of problems we have in America. These are problems that I wrote about 15 years ago and have brought up to date in the new version of State of Confusion. I think most people would agree something has gone wrong in America. And I think they would probably agree that it feels like it's something of a psychological nature. But they're struggling with how to understand it and, above all, what we can do about it. And that's really why I wrote State of Confusion. I think that the critical challenge facing America now is to recognize the nature of the human mind. That's the instrument with which we're trying to address these problems. Now, the mind is an organ like other parts of the body. We think of our stomach and our heart, and we know that they're miraculous, but they're limited in terms of what they can do, and they're greatly affected by how we treat them. And the same thing is true with the American mind, and we are not paying a lot of attention to that mind. And I describe it in State of Confusion. I describe the vulnerable areas of the mind, what's been done to it, and above all, what it is that we can do to try to correct things and put the country back on a rational track.
Some of what you write about reminds me of the kind of manipulation that, say, advertisers and marketing, you know, marketing executives have taken advantage of for years. We live in a consumerist country, and American advertisers have been very aggressive for many, many years. They've managed to, you know, manipulate us into wanting to buy things we don't need. But of course, the meeting of psychology and politics is also a very old phenomenon. I'm thinking back to the power of propaganda under Hitler and Mussolini, and the oratorial attempts of dictators to convince masses of people to do things that defy reason. So we know that we are vulnerable psychologically, but don't we also today, because of new research into how the brain works, know more than ever before about brains?
No, you've touched on both the bad news and the good news, Sonali. Yes, there's been political manipulation since the beginning of time, But what happened beginning in the late 60s and for the last 50 years, television and mass media has created an ability to probe right inside the human mind and to create certain kinds of experiences that are going to influence it, not necessarily in its own best interest. And that's what I'm talking about in State of Confusion. If we can take time to look at that mind and to understand the vulnerability areas, I call them the battleground states. They're not red states or blue states, but they're psychological states. Paranoia, sexual perplexity, envy and greed. Those are the three battleground states that are really driving how the American mind is feeling inside Americans, and that in turn will shape what they do in the polls and how they formulate their opinions. It began, you know, in 1960 with the Nixon-Kennedy debate. For the first time, people who had been at a much greater distance from their political candidate could now have a close-up, visceral experience of John Kennedy, who was cool and handsome, and contrast it with Richard Nixon, who was sweaty and jowly. Now, whether one liked Kennedy better or Nixon better, the fact is we want our decisions to be made on the basis of more rational processes than this visceral kind of experience that people have inside them and shapes their bodily experience. Now, with Madison Avenue building on that, we've got television has been a very powerful probe right inside the mind where we can create very, very primitive kinds of experiences inside people's very being. It's visceral. And then we can influence how they move politically.
And of course, we have social media and Facebook, all of which is, you know, being examined after the 2016 election, the role that these social media companies played as tools to manipulate masses of people. So we I mean, it's really quite it's a psychological experiment on a mass scale.
It absolutely is. And just the volume of material. The biggest task of the mind is to create our reality sense. Now, most of us think that reality is just something out there that we perceive, but it's not true. There's so much out there to perceive and so much coming from inside us that the mind has to organize and select that material and create a cohesive sense of reality that's unique to that individual. Now, when the mind has a hard time doing that, as it does when it's bombarded, when it's traumatized by the dissolution of the family, economic dislocation, economic fear, it has a hard time forming that reality. It struggles. And when people have a hard time creating a reality sense, whether it's a true one or an incorrect one or not, when they have a hard time doing it, they get very anxious. Now, one of two things happens. They cease to function independently, or they do so erratically, or they turn the reality formation task over to some external figure who appears to be powerful, who appears to be quite certain, and who will give them a self-indulgent kind of pleasant visceral experience. And that's what we see going on now in a very primitive fashion in this country.
And so Trump is paying attention to people who have felt neglected.
He is doing that, and he is giving them that kind of visceral experience, which basically is whatever you want to feel, you go right ahead and feel it. And he embodies that himself. If you want to be sexually primitive, go ahead and be sexually primitive. If you want to defy the pressures of recognizing the state of the planet, go ahead and defy it. It's okay. If you look at Trump's personal diet of cheeseburgers and chicken and soft drinks, it's a personification of someone who says, whatever I want, I can have. Now, the problem with that is it's not reality, and it undercuts people's ability and their sense of necessity to be reasonable, to use judgment and discernment. That gets very old and gets very tiring for a mind that's already beleaguered. So it's in the area of forming reality that we are struggling. Now, At the same time, when we're struggling to form our own reality, the notion that someone else has a different reality is quite threatening to us. And that's why we're so divided as a country. We have always had differences of opinion, liberal, conservative, what have you. But we've been able to tolerate those and not hate one another. But when the mind is unstable and shaky itself, then that becomes something that the mind can't do. And hence you have the gridlock and the growing divide and hatred in the country. So that is, it's the mind and the specific mechanisms of the mind that are creating the problem. But if we don't pay attention to the mind, we're not even looking in the ballpark where the answer lies.
So of course, these traumas that can make us vulnerable to manipulation, that manipulation is sometimes referred to as, or a particular type of manipulation is referred to as gaslighting. This is something that we've heard more and more in the Trump era as something that this president is particularly good at. Can you explain what that is and how somebody like Trump uses this method of manipulation?
Yeah, it was a big part of the book that I wrote in 2008 was explaining the dangers of psychological gaslighting. Gaslighting pertains to disrupting a person's ability to trust in their own perception of reality. That makes them anxious. It makes them turn to someone like a demagogue to tell them what it is. And it basically renders them much less effective to think individually and to think for themselves. It's based on a 1944 movie by the name Gaslight. And the term comes from the fact that the husband in the movie was trying to drive his wife crazy so he could take over her inheritance. And the way he did that was to try to undercut her trust in her own perceptions, which is what we see happening in America today. So when the gas lights, he would raise the gas lights. She would say, "Who turned up the lights?" He would say, "No one turned up the lights. They haven't changed." And so she gradually became more mistrustful of her own abilities and kept turning more and more of her autonomous functioning over to her husband. So it's that kind of undercutting of people's ability to form the reality sense that I'm talking about that is so central. And it's stunning what can happen to people when they get frightened and when they lose their ability to make sense of the world around them. They get irrational themselves, function less independently, and they become more vulnerable to demagogues.
Is that to say that a majority of Trump supporters are people who've experienced some sort of trauma? I mean, there were plenty of sort of, you know, middle class, well-educated whites that voted for Trump. Some suggest that there's just a deep racism in that, you know, in a certain sector of the American electorate that will always be there. And when you have somebody like Trump coming along, egging on their racism and joining on with it, they'll vote for him.
Well, I hate to accept the notion that it will always be there, but what's clear is it is there now. And I do make clear in the book that the principles I'm talking about are not just applicable to people who support Trump. Because those of us who are trying to defeat Trump aren't doing all that well either, right, in our efforts. And the trauma, you know, 75 to 80% of Americans have suffered from a significant psychological trauma. And it's so common now, we take it for granted, but we're not paying attention to the price we pay for that trauma. It's not just in the political arena. It's in the very quality, the innermost experience that we all have. So it's not at all just Trump supporters. But I do think we're seeing for many people who support Trump, even though he does things completely inconsistent with their values and their best interests, they are so locked into being dependent on him and to some extent addicted to the kind of experience he gives them, the relief, the catharsis from the psychological burdens of having to live in a complex society where we have to be able to understand that superficial differences like skin color or sexual orientation are not the big things that people feel they are when they're struggling to maintain some sense of reality. Trump has held up a very ugly mirror to ourselves, and you can see the kind of misogyny and the role of paranoia and the greed that are really being used to manipulate the American mind.
Let's talk about some of these issues, and you refer to them as battleground states. Paranoia is a big one. I recall during the Obama presidency, you had these really bizarre fears that Obama was going to take away everybody's guns, even though he never came out and said such a thing. You know, there was a paranoia that he wasn't really a citizen. He was going to bring Sharia law onto the shores of the United States. How do we understand paranoia when reality offers a completely different, state of being?
I spend a lot of time in State of Confusion talking about paranoia. It is a fascinating psychological process. Most of us recognize it as a term meaning kind of irrational fear, but it's much more complex and really much richer than that. Paranoia refers to our ability to differentiate what experience is inside us and what experience is outside in the environment. When we have an unpleasant internal experience, the mind is really able to project the blame for that experience, to put it out into some certain time, place, or person, and in that way create the illusion that if one can just stay away from the other person or defeat them or vanquish them or kill them, that they will then be safe from that unpleasant apprehension they have. So when the mind is anxious to begin with, and then you have an event like 9/11, which really rattled the American mind, then you have someone come along and say, hey, the enemy is over there. It's the axis of evil of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. I mean, what an unlikely alliance. But the mind is eager to find some explanation for this disquieting inner experience. And along comes a strong figure who said, hey, it's over there. And so in Trump's version of it, the incredibly irrational animosity towards Hillary Clinton, whether one agrees with her policies or not, she is not someone that needs to be locked up, and she's not someone that should be loathed. So this is the kind of stirring up of these battleground states that I talked about. And in the book, I explain why those states are such areas of vulnerability to us.
Then there's the greed and envy, which sort of go together. I feel like I'm talking about sort of biblical values. But how do you explain, especially envy, which seems to be something that affects a lot of Americans when it comes to trying to distinguish themselves versus other and the fear of the other?
I think envy is one of the most fascinating and under-talked about psychological concepts. We all, you mentioned at the beginning, the role of marketeers and advertisers. The whole economy is dependent upon creating a state inside us that we're dissatisfied and that we need something outside us in order to feel happy. And so our country has been trained over and over again that there's something wrong, and if you want to solve it, you've got to go get something. Now, that's greed. And then what happens? We see some people get a lot more of it, and it doesn't necessarily mean material goods. Our society emphasizes physical attraction. So maybe somebody's more attractive than we are. Or somebody has more than we have, and it creates a resentment.
Thinking about affirmative action and how people view people of color being able to go to college and universities, and then that being cast as somehow stealing the seats that belong to white Americans.
Exactly. What I have, someone else steals. Now, as I say in the book, we don't like to acknowledge ourselves as envious. It's a little degrading, makes us feel inferior. So what happens is the mind will suddenly shift it. And it's not that someone got something we didn't get. is that someone stole something that we should have had. Someone's been given an unfair advantage. And so what is envy will come up as a kind of a self-righteous resentment and a hatred. I think that this takes place in a number of different battleground areas. There's no question.
You have an interesting chapter in your book about sexual perplexity, which, you know, this is a term that I think is worth exploring, especially when we have attacks on LGBTQ Americans that are so vicious. You know, some of the progress that had been made before Trump really has been undone under Trump in a way that also seems to confuse many of the rest of us who want to see greater rights for LGBTQ people. How do we understand the psychology of sexual perplexity?
Yeah. Sexuality, our gender identity, our sexual orientation. If you look at the model of the mind that I talked about, of us trying to define and to make sense of the world and to get a sense of how we should operate in the world, gender and sexual issues are incredibly important. And when the mind is struggling in other areas, if someone tampers with our understanding of what those expectations are, if we see that someone expresses sexuality different from the way we do, it's unbelievably threatening and it's very disruptive. So if you look at, you can take, it takes different forms, but with Clinton in the, or really with Al Gore in the 2000 election, the role of the blue dress, just the semen of the president on a blue dress tainted the next presidential election. People, the yuck factor, I think it was called, even though Al Gore was pretty much beyond reproach in that regard, it was aversive for them. Or you can look at 2004, the role of the gay marriage. All across the country, people saw pictures of men kissing men on the courthouse steps in San Francisco. And for people who were heterosexual, it's just a basic rule of sexuality that sexuality that is not what turns us on disgusts us. Think of a small child when they first hear about sex, they respond with one word, yuck. And that's the kind of experience that the country had when they had to discover that there were other people who had a different form of sexual expression.
And yet, President Trump's dalliances with adult film actresses, affairs outside his marriage, don't seem to disgust his base.
No. And, you know, we saw that in the Alabama election. And yeah, I think what that means, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, the Christian right are hypocrites. I don't think so. I think what that's a measure of is how locked and shut down many of those minds are, that once they decide that you batten the hatches and Trump's our man, you don't look at the incongruencies, you don't look at the inconsistencies, you shut them out. But sexuality comes up I thought it determined the election in 2016. I think the irrational hatred towards Hillary Clinton, whether you like her or not, you don't hate somebody because they have the wrong internet server. It's just not high up on the emotionally charged list. And yet a lot of people who viscerally hated Hillary Clinton really think that's the reason. So it's the sexuality, the central role it plays in helping us define our reality, our role in reality. When we have an experience in that area, it really discombobulates us, and people will start responding to that rather than whether they want better schools for their kids or whether they want better infrastructure, whether they want healthcare, because you rattle them at the deepest part of their meaning when you start talking about sexually perplexing kind of issues.
Well, finally, Bryant, our conversation wouldn't be complete if we didn't discuss how to address this state that we are in, the state of utter confusion. We've become vulnerable. We are being manipulated in different ways. But we do have a greater understanding of the mind. As somebody who knows politics in Washington, D.C., but is also a clinical psychologist, how do you hope that we as a people can restore our sanity?
Well, yeah, and I really can say, in spite of the concerns that I raise in State of Confusion, the real reason for writing the second book is that I've never been more optimistic about what we could do with the mind. Hmm. You mentioned at the beginning, Sonali, that with neuroscience, we now know a lot about the mind. And really, a wonderful thing that's happening is the Renaissance-like cross-fertilization that's taking place with scholars from the Eastern part of the world coming to the West and integrating the Tibetan Buddhism with Western psychology. As a clinician, I've never felt better about what we can do for people coming into our office. And the same principles hold true for what we can do across the country. The biggest thing is we are so lucky because I swear half of our battle is won just with awareness, awareness. Now, I use that word and everybody goes, oh, okay, I'm aware. But awareness psychologically is a very profound thing. And my neuroscientist friends will say, if you can name it, you can tame it. And that is what we're discovering is true about the mind. So if we can become aware, first of all, the fact we got a mind and we got to pay attention to it, then we start noticing how the mind works and how it can be manipulated and how we can combat that kind of manipulation. There's a lot of growth that can take place. And it's not expensive. It's not like you have to go into psychoanalysis or anything else. We can teach this to kids in elementary school. And one of the reasons the mindfulness craze has gotten such a following is because people are so hungry to address the inner state of their experience. And once we do that, we're then able to make better connection with others. We become more loving, more effective. So there is an enormous amount. There's an enormous amount we can do, and with the optimism, I wish I could say I think we will do it, but we could do it, and that's why I wrote State of Confusion.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Bryant. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Sonali. Appreciate it.
Bryant Welch is a nationally renowned clinical psychologist and attorney. His book, State of Confusion, was first released in 2008. We've just been discussing the latest edition of that book. The full title is State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.